Argument next in number 2010-5131, Allied Technology Group against the United States. Mr. Claybrook, when you're ready.
I am, Your Honor. Thank you very much, and good morning, Your Honors. I'm going to take the issues this morning in the order presented in our brief, so let's begin by talking about the contracting officer disqualifying Allied on the stated basis that Allied took six specified exceptions to the RFQ's terms and conditions. The CEO did this without giving Allied a chance to resolve that matter in discussions. The problem with this is that the RFQ was amended to address this very situation. This was a FAR Part 8.4 procurement, which requires that offerors must offer goods or services they already have on a contract with the GSA's federal supply schedule. All FSS offerings have standard T's and C's, which have already been approved by the GSA and are part of the package of that offering. Now, the RFQ, as originally drafted and issued, asked offerors to highlight or identify the differences between their standard T's and C's and their FSS contract and the RFQ's T's and C's. Allied asked for clarification about this. It wanted to know whether these differences, or exceptions as the RFQ called them, could put it at risk of being disqualified, especially when the draft RFQ expressly stated that the government, I'm quoting now, reserves the right not to accept any exceptions to this RFQ. DOJ then amended the RFQ. It removed that language that I just quoted, and it said that the offeror would only be removed from consideration due to its standard T's and C's if the perceived exceptions to the RFQ's T's and C's, quote, cannot be resolved, close quote. After briefing, all the parties agree that this cannot be resolved language means exactly what it says, in that it indicates an attempted resolution by the parties through discussions. The trial court, though, points to the general statement in the RFQ that the government, quote, intends, close quote, to make an award without discussions. And the trial court then supposedly harmonizes that provision with the cannot be resolved clause to mean that the agency had put Allied on notice that it could be disqualified without any attempt to resolve any perceived exceptions to the CO thought so significant that they required disqualification. This fails to read the RFQ provisions harmoniously or to read the RFQ as a whole. That same general clause, which says the government intends...
Aren't you reading the cannot be resolved? The contract from the beginning, from the initial draft straight through, provided, seemed to me pretty clearly that the government had the discretion, if it wanted to conduct discussions, if it determined them to be necessary. That's the language in the contract, right?
It does have that clause in it. I'm sorry.
And it's been right straight throughout. So the notion is, well, and the contract said we're going to try to decide this one without discussion. That's what the contract said also, right?
Yes.
Okay. So as a result of your inquiry, the cannot be resolved language got put in there. And as I read, what you're saying is the contract's initial provision and final provision saying discussions will occur if the government wants them is a unilateral situation. Discussions only happen if the government wants them. You're saying that the cannot be resolved language converts the otherwise clear language that the discussion is a unilateral matter into a bilateral matter. That you're saying you have a right to force them to have a discussion with you.
Yes, or put otherwise, Your Honor.
But that the if what I'm going to read is cannot be resolved is an amendment to the other clear provisions in the contract that says only the government has the right to decide if there's going to be a discussion, you may have an ambiguity. Now, given the fact that the government has if they have the unilateral power to decide whether to have discussions, then why can't we assume that the government decided, with regard to your client's deficiencies, that the issue cannot be resolved? You're too far apart. No sense having discussions.
Well, what happened here, Your
Honor?
Now,
if that's the case, then you don't have a leg to stand on.
What happened here, Your Honor, is that basically the government limited its own discretion by adding this specific clause for this situation. And so
there's a conflict.
Please.
The difference between bilateral authority for discussions and unilateral is day and night.
There's no conflict here, Your Honor. What that clause says in the very next sentence from what you've been talking about is that the government also reserves the right.
You're saying you can make the government have a discretion.
And they can limit their discretion, yes. And when they added the cannot be resolved language, and it took out the clause that says that any exception can cause disqualification, added another clause called exceptions that says it only be a downgrade, they were limiting their discretion, and they were basically saying, in this specific situation, it is in our best interest to have discussions, and we will have discussions in that. So that reading harmonizes all the provisions.
How do we know that the agency didn't decide that it didn't need to have a discussion with you? There was no sense trying to discuss with you. You're saying that the order of precedence clause in some other document governs, notwithstanding the provision in the contract that says our order of precedence clause.
That is inconsistent with the way they amended the RFQ and the Hornbook.
Couldn't the contracting officer reasonably say to himself, I don't need to have discussions with you. We're so far apart, we're never going to get anywhere.
No, he could not under this situation because he doesn't know if the offeror will alter its proposal.
That depends on whether or not the contracting officer has the unilateral, whether the decision to conduct discussions belongs to the government alone.
And it does not here. And what the law requires is that the procurement be conducted in accordance with the solicitation. When a specific clause has been added in response to a specific question about this, the agency binds itself and by law must follow what it says it's going to do in the solicitation. Otherwise, under that view of the matter, the cannot be resolved clause has no meaning whatsoever.
You complete your thought and then I'll move on.
No, it just makes it's superfluous under that reading.
Let me ask you this, and it's getting to an aspect of the case that's discussed in another context, but it seems to me to have some at least potential application here. If the contracting officer had simply said, well, all right, I don't really want to get into a lot of discussions and back and forth. I'll just deem the exceptions not to be a problem. So I'll resolve this without discussion by simply sweeping away the problems of the exceptions. And then had gone to assess the two competing proposals and had chosen Monster. This issue would disappear, would it not?
It would if we were not disqualified.
Right. But the CO says, well, I went ahead, notwithstanding the exceptions, and I assessed the two and I came out in favor of Monster, we did collectively. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that put you in the same position with respect to this discussion issue that you would have been in my hypothetical?
No, because
you understand what I'm saying?
Maybe I don't.
Maybe I didn't express myself clearly. In other words, the effect of what the CO seems to have said is to sweep the whole issue of exceptions off the table, seems to me, by saying even if there were no problems with the exceptions at all, we still would have picked Monster. In which case, I don't see where your discussions issue, which is directed at resolving the exceptions, gives you an argument that you were prejudiced by the absence of discussions.
I
don't know if that's clearer.
Two parts to my answer. Sure. First, obviously, we attack the technical evaluation, the best evaluation.
I understand. But
you put that aside. Yeah. If they had conducted discussions as they have been required to have done here, they also would have to have talked about any other things that they saw that were they considered to be significant weaknesses or deficiencies, and we would have had another opportunity to have revised our proposal. So you really just don't know
But there's no evidence.
But I think you and I were agreeing earlier that they, one option they could have done without violating the discussions provision would be to say, we're just not going to have any objection to the exceptions.
Yes.
We'll just accept the bid
yes.
as such. In which case, we would be in the position, it seems to me, at least setting aside the dispute about the technical evaluations, we would be in the position of essentially having an evaluation which ultimately came out against your client.
Correct.
And where's the prejudice from the lack of discussions under those circumstances?
I'd have to win on the bad technical.
Right. Okay. So essentially this issue drops out and the bad technical issue becomes the critical issue. Right.
It's one I have to win on as well. It doesn't drop out because they did disqualify us.
Well,
Had discussions. They would have had another chance to present offers.
Can I ask you, if you're finished on this issue, can I ask you to turn to the 508 issue? Because I
sure.
will say candidly that gives me some concern.
Yeah. Monster took exceptions to the 508 requirements that require internet technology to be accessible for the blind and other handicapped employees and users of the system. The Court of Federal Claims found that the exceptions that Monster took were what it called minor and gave Monster a free pass, even though the agency had made no such minor finding. But even if it had, that would not do the trick under Section 508 because Congress only allows one way to get around full compliance with 508, and that's by a written finding of undue burden by the agency. The agency made no such undue burden finding here. And a court may not make that finding for the agency or decide what is minor in the circumstances that the agency finds itself in and what is not. That violates both 508 and the Chenery Rule. I want to stress that there's no basis in the record for the trial court's finding that Monster's self-confessed noncompliances are minor. Again, the agency didn't make that finding, and Monster says its system's noncompliant.
Doesn't that minor point come from whoever it was that did the assessment of Monster's program?
And it comes from Monster's briefs, principally.
No, but it refers to the whoever it was that examined their system to decide whether it complied. It was an independent group.
The BART group, the SST
yes.
BART group.
Yeah.
Right. And what it said was...
What about the Labatt argument? I mean, your client dropped the 508 ball in a major way because you didn't give a certification.
Okay. Let me finish... Your initial question. Monster's consultants themselves call it their problems, their noncompliances relate to accessibility with forms, text equivalents for non-text elements, and keyboard accessibility. This procurement is all about using and manipulating forms, and you do that through keyboard accessibility. And when you fill out job applications, you put in lots of non-text elements, lots of numbers. So there's no way that anyone could find this to be minor at this level. Now, let's talk about Labatt. That was a situation in which the protester was complaining about the very problem that it had itself was guilty
of. Your point is that Labatt, you agree that Labatt would knock you out of the box here if it were on all fours. If neither side had submitted a 508 declaration, bang.
If my complaint was they were not submitting a 508 certification, then yeah, I couldn't.
Well, one could look at it as if they supplied a certification, they supplied an independent review showing wherein they were deficient, and you didn't supply anything at all that was required. So your failure was utter, their failure was not utter.
Well, obviously,
that's one way of looking at it.
Well,
correct?
That would be a wrong way of looking at it. We supplied the equivalent of the certification on not just one, but two occasions.
Let me ask you this question. Does the effect of a certification here, and I'm talking now, of course, about Monster's certification of compliance, does that have the effect of converting the issue of compliance from a solicitation qualification exception, if you will, well, that's the way Monster described it, into a contract performance issue?
That is to say, and I think you understand what I'm saying, but to make sure we're on the same page. Contract administration, such that if Monster, having promised that it's compliant, if it somehow falls short of compliance with the product that it ultimately produces for use, then the Department of Justice would be able to say, no, you're not living up to your compliance.
No, it doesn't in these circumstances, okay. Your Honor.
Why not?
Because the exception sheet is not technical exception. It's really, are you taking exception to the terms and conditions? And they list these as, they're not saying, oh, we're going to fix it in 90 days or 100 days or whatever, or we're going to get there. It's saying, we're never going to do it. Not going to do it ever.
So what is the effect of the compliance certification? Is that compliance with 508 minus our exceptions? Is that the effect of it? Or does it mean that there's an inconsistency between the certification and the exception?
It's just a duplicative form. Monster miscertified that they were going to comply. The page before says, we're not going to comply with, here are the exceptions to our compliance. So you have to read them together.
Is there anything to be, should we be concerned at all about the visuals? My understanding is that the contracting officer looked at both systems, made a visual look. So is it possible that these exceptions that you say are not minor were corrected?
No, Your Honor. These are things that there's no record evidence for that. What the record shows is that the contracting officer just missed it altogether.
Other than the fact that the contracting officer, who we believe acts in the ordinary course, accepted a complete certification saying, I certify compliance, even though the monster had rubbed the contracting officer's nose in the exceptions.
Well, what happened here was that the contracting officer said the monster took no exceptions. That's just clearly wrong on this record. He just missed it.
What do you say to the, I had a second question along the same lines that we were discussing earlier, well, perhaps slightly different. Under 1194.2b, there is, as I understand it, an obligation to purchase a commercially available system that does comply if one is available. And if one is not available, then you can back away from complete compliance in your acquisition.
Or you can do an undue burden.
Right. But even without an undue burden, you can back away from insisting on complete compliance, as I understand that regulation, without doing the formal undue burden determination. So if the effect of Allied's submission of a bid that did not, let's assume for the moment that it effectively disqualified itself as a competing bidder by virtue of its exceptions. If the effect of that is to take Allied out of the picture as being effectively a commercially available system to perform as requested, then doesn't that leave us with one bidder, which then can be accepted for less than complete compliance with 508?
No, it doesn't in this situation.
Why not?
It might in some others, but right. Not in this, because you have an FSS offering, a government contract, in which that, by definition, is commercially available. These are commercial items. And so ABU's FSS offering is available and it's conforming.
I understand that argument.
So
but
you
what
didn't
I'm
have to
saying
go to the
is,
undue burden to make.
You could have an FSS offering, and perhaps this is hypothetical, and you're the incumbent, and presumably they're satisfied with that you've complied with whatever was required to be done. But at least in the abstract, you could certainly have a commercially available product, but it just doesn't happen to be the particular product that the agency wants to buy. And in that setting, the fact that it's a commercially available product is irrelevant to the inquiry here, it would seem to me. In other words, you could have a system that had a much cruder computer system, but it complied. But it's not what the agency wants. It's not what the agency is asking for solicitation responses for.
Our system meets the technical requirements. If you had a loop, Congress did not put in a loophole of meet 508 unless you don't want to meet 508 or don't want to comply or you don't want a product that doesn't comply or that does comply. I mean, it's not the way it's set up.
Well, what I'm saying really is, and perhaps you're saying, well, we did satisfy the requirements of the solicitation and therefore that issue doesn't come up. But if you didn't, If we should conclude that you didn't satisfy the requirements of the solicitation, then aren't you outside of the sphere that the government has to look to determine whether there are competing products for purposes of this regulation?
It still has to look and see whether they're competing products, but...
Well, but competing products within what sphere? The sphere, I would assume, of products that are what the government wants to buy.
That meets the RFQ, that meets the statement of work.
Right, and if your product doesn't meet the RFQ because it's disqualified by virtue of the exceptions you're taking.
No, technical requirements, Your Honor, not terms and conditions requirements.
All right.
I've exceeded my time. And
we've questioned you very heavily. If you have a final thought,
I have a whole final argument about the technical.
What argument? On the technical?
Yeah.
I think that's an issue that we feel pretty comfortable with. We've studied the briefs closely, and I think we're... And if you have one thought you want to focus on,
Maybe a minute of rebuttal.
We'll give you your full rebuttal.
Open it now so if they come and so you can return on rebuttal. We're trying to give you a chance to lay this argument on the table.
So, Mike, make sure you talk about the technical.
Okay, well, we'll reserve your full rebuttal time. And we'll hear now from, let's see, who's going to go first? Mr. O'Connell?
Yes.
Very well.
Thank you. May it please support. This is the case of a contractor that pursued a risky proposal strategy that simply backfired. It then sought relief.
Just to be sure, you're representing the government here.
Yes.
Co-counsel is monster.
Yes. It's the case of a contractor that pursued a risky proposal strategy that backfired. It then sought relief from its business decisions from the GAO and the Court of Federal Claims. What the record shows is that the agency, the GAO, and the trial court gave Allied the benefit of every doubt, but they all still concluded that the proper awardee was Monster Government Solutions.
Well, we understand the background that you paint for the case is a little different from the one they paint. Let's cut to the chase. What's your argument on the contract language cannot be resolved?
That has to be read in light of the rest of the RFQ, which twice tells the offerors that the government intends to award without discussions. It's strictly up to the CO. So all the "in cannot be resolved" language means is that if the government holds discussions, then some attempt could be made to address the exceptions. But
What does the language? What meaning do you give to those three words under your interpretation of the contract?
It means that if there's discussions, they can talk about it and try to resolve the exceptions.
If there are exceptions, they can have discussions?
They can. Well, no. If the contracting officer, for whatever reason, decides to hold discussions, they can attempt to resolve the exceptions. If they don't, then they can be found unacceptable. But that language, in and of itself, reading the RFQ as a whole, doesn't make those discussions mandatory.
Does the reason why the language comes into the contract make any difference? This is the argument your adversary is making is, you know, don't do a patent ambiguity thing on me, guys. There was one. I went in and asked for clarification, and here's what I got.
Right. Well, my response to that is you should do a patent ambiguity analysis because they're told that the government intends to award without discussions. It's strictly up to the CO. And what they're saying is, no, it's not strictly up to the CO.
So your argument, I guess, is that if Allied comes away from the insertion of the cannot be resolved language, they come away thinking that they have a bilateral relationship with regard to discussions, then they better go get that clarified.
Right. Because the actual...
most the language has done is to create a patent ambiguity.
At most, because the government didn't remove the language that they objected to. They left it in. So that's telling in and of itself that they leave it in. But then when they also add the words in that sentence that we're not talking about, which is remove from consideration, which the draft didn't say at all. So that's the second telling fact. So how they claim to draw some comfort for the fact that we left the language in that they complained about and added language specifically telling them that they could be removed
from
consideration.
Their argument on that is that you put the teeth in to say that you may be disqualified. That means all the more reason why you would have to have discussions.
Well, it's all the more reason why you should clarify it prior to bid. That's what I would say.
What's your comment on the fact that this cannot be resolved provision is under the heading Part 4 Additional Documents. To what extent does that mean that this language only relates to certain things and not others?
Well, I don't agree with that because that paragraph starts out by saying, by talking about the RFQ as a whole, and the contracting officer is telling them to identify the exceptions on a separate piece of paper just so that they stick out. I don't know if I'm sure you've noticed that the proposals here are several hundred pages long, so it just makes it easy for the contracting officer if the exceptions are on a separate page.
Now, did I misunderstand you earlier as arguing that the cannot be resolved language only is triggered if there is some determination by the contracting officer that a discussion is warranted?
Yes, because the right.
That's the position you're taking.
Yes.
But that's not what the language says. The language provides, sort of, as I read it, two conditions to a determination that an offer should be removed from consideration. One, that a provision is considered unacceptable, and two, that the unacceptability cannot be resolved. It has nothing to do with discussions. It's just these are the two conditions predicate to an offer being removed from consideration.
But the only way that they could attempt to resolve an exception is through discussions. There's simply no other way to do it. So that brings into consideration the other contract terms that provide that we intend to award without discussions, and to harmonize those provisions means that you only get a chance to resolve your exceptions if the contracting officer decides to hold discussions.
What about the language the contracting officer's decision at page A1132 at the top? Monster took no exceptions. This gets us into this 508 issue.
Yes. And I think you have to read that in context because the other thing that's being discussed here is all the major exceptions that Allied took. Contracting officers clearly concerned about major exceptions, but it's reasonable reading this in context to mean that he wasn't concerned about the 508 exception.
What is about the context tells us that the word no exceptions means no major
because
exceptions.
It's followed by a half a page discussing all the major exceptions that Allied took, material exceptions.
Okay.
It seems there's a little bit of a leap of logic there, isn't there?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, keep in mind, please, a couple of other things. First of all, there's 114 functional, technical, and security requirements that the contractors have to certify that they can meet under this proposal. So the contracting officer doesn't have the resources to go out and validate whether the contractors can do these. So he has to be able to rely upon the representations from the contractors. And if he can rely on the representations from the contractors, it follows that he can also rely upon their representation and certification that the exception is minor. What the court said when faced with a comparable argument in the Axiom case is that the court noted that the contractor is subject to various remedies under the contract. In addition, I would point out that there's also a host of extra contractual remedies that the government has, some of which can be very harsh. So there's a strong incentive on the part of a contractor not to exaggerate and not to misrepresent, because very bad things can happen if it does. So as a result, because of the contractual and statutory framework, the contracting officer can rely upon these, and then if it turns out that the contractor misrepresented, then it can be dealt with as part of contract administration.
Well, now, has Monster, in your view, pursuant to its bid, has it undertaken to be fully 508 compliant, or has it undertaken to be 508 compliant with the designated exceptions?
Well, all I can tell you is they've been performing for a year.
Well, tell me what you think the contract means.
Well, under 508, there's a rule of reason. As it's already been pointed out, the government isn't required to pay top dollar to get the most compliant system, and isn't required if people don't bid on the contracts. Isn't
this the undue burden?
This is both undue burden and the other one, the other exception that provides that that the government can, in certain cases, award to a less than fully compliant, you know, based upon the marketplace that was discussed earlier.
But that's if there is no other available candidate in the marketplace.
Let me, isn't that what the regulation says?
Can I
discuss them both in tandem, if you don't mind the undue burden and the other one? I mean, reading those together, there's a rule of reason under this statute. We don't have to pay top dollar, which this case is a perfect example of, for the most compliant exception, for the most compliant product. The statute says we don't have to award to the more expensive company if it would be an undue burden. The regulations define undue burden as a significant expense, which is a very low threshold for the government to make. The contracting officers already found here that the price difference between the two companies is overwhelming. And just the plain English language meaning of overwhelming means to overcome completely, to overpower. So it's clear that under what the contracting officers already said that we meet that test, number one. But number two, given the price difference that's set forth in the briefs and the decisions, I mean, it's considering prejudice, it's just inconceivable that in the current fiscal environment that any contracting officer in the government would find this price difference to be insignificant.
Now, the undue burden, as I understand it, typically requires that you go through a particular sequence of analytical steps. That
right.
wasn't done in this case, I take it.
Other than the statement about it being overwhelming that I already said, he didn't make any kind of written finding. But that's why I'm asking you to consider it under prejudice that's required under the case law.
Right. Now, we don't want to run your co-counsel out of time here, so why don't you go ahead and make whatever further point you would like to make, but I want to make sure and reserve some time for your co-counsel.
Sure. Let me just finish up by saying that prejudice here is very important, not only for the reasons I've already said, but the case is squarely governed by the court's holdings in the court's opinions in Data General and Banham. Just like in Data General here, we have no representation either at the GAO or at the Court of Federal Claims that the price would be lowered enough to compete effectively with Monster. And under Banham, there's nothing more than a theoretical possibility that the scores would change significantly if the case were remanded. Despite all of Allied's complaints about the scoring, it's a couple decimal points from receiving the highest score, excellent. It simply can't go up that much. What it needed to show under Banham was that Monster's score would drop precipitously. As I said, 114 requirements here. When this case started at the GAO, Allied was contending literally that Monster couldn't meet dozens of the requirements under the RFQ. They've dropped almost every one of those arguments, so they're effectively conceding that Monster can meet 112 of the 114 requirements. And even the two that it's complaining about still, the Social Security numbers and 508, the complaints go more towards the technical acceptability of the product rather than the quality of the product that would be judged under the technical evaluation.
Can I ask you one more question? And I'm violating my own injunction against extending the time. But if I understood, I'm not sure where this comes from, but somewhere in the record I got the impression that the 508 noncompliance issue was a noncompliance on the department side of the system, not on the applicant side of the system. Is that right, or am I...
Perhaps your co-counsel will be better than me on that question.
In any event, let's hear from your co-counsel.
Thank you, and ask that the court affirm the trial court.
Mr. Morehouse, we are going to be giving your opposing counsel some extra time, so we will not limit you to the remaining time here.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Feel free to take
it. Good morning, and may it please the court. I would like to address the 508 issue, if I may, from Monster's perspective. I'm a little disturbed in hearing some of the statements by counsel for Allied in its argument using terms such as Monster was not compliant or took exception or miscertified that it was compliant. It had an independent VPAT consultant, looked at its system, and found that it was generally compliant with certain minor exceptions, which it indicated, and that is precisely what Monster reported to the government.
The certification, though, was not qualified. It was a certification of compliance.
During contract performance, Your Honor.
Yes.
Well, this is... counsel for Allied has taken a contract formation, proposal evaluation issue out of the 508 compliance when it really is a performance contract administration issue.
So you think then, let me repeat the same question I asked of your opposing counsel. You think then that the certification by Monster of compliance in the administration of the contract binds Monster to complete compliance with 508, not to compliance minus the non-complying exception portion of Monster's performance. Is that correct?
It is compliance to the extent, and as I believe the question was just asked, is compliance as directed by the agency or as directed by the statute? And we say it is as directed by the agency because it says that each federal department of agency shall ensure. And it is a matter of contract administration what they shall ensure. There is nothing in that statute that says that minor exceptions are not permitted. In fact, the GAO in its CourtSmart decision said there can be varying levels of compliance with 508. And it is up to an agency to make the determination which offer best meets those requirements consistent with price and other considerations. There is no absolute rule. In fact, if I may make the point, and I believe it is known as the Delaney Clause, that the law does not engage in trifles, where a statute does not expressly say we will not permit de minimis exceptions. De minimis exceptions are allowed in interpreting that statute.
How do we know the exceptions here were de minimis?
We know that they were minor because that is...
How do we know that? We the word minor is used apparently by SS Bart Group?
Yes.
How do we know that Bart Group knows what's minor or major in the context of what's
well,
going on?
Well, I would say, Your Honor, because they are in the business of verifying the compliance with 508, and Monster hid nothing under the no light under the bushel on this one. They got an independent third party. We would assume that SS Bart knows what it means by minor.
Well, suppose that, hypothetically, suppose that SS Bart, though these comply to the extent that anybody who has a disability, other than blindness, let's say, can use this thing perfectly well.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't that many blind people, particularly blind people who apply for jobs at the Department of Justice, let's say, and therefore
right.
It's minor. Even though a blind person would have a complete incapacity to deal with the system, would that be minor?
I don't think there's anything that indicates there is any failing of the system to allow blind people to use it. You may have, for example,
I thought that was in the nature of the system was that there wasn't a screen accessibility that would be necessary for a blind person to use that.
I think
right?
In one or two instances. I think, for example, is the analogy that we've used. If they have to be a textual or speaking representation of an image, a non-textual image.
Right.
You may have, I don't know how many screens of text or how many lines of computer information, and I am only a layperson, that in a few instances you might have, for example, a picture of a rabbit, if I may, and there is not on that particular image, the system doesn't say to a blind person orally, picture of rabbit, or something in Braille that would said, you're looking at a picture of a rabbit.
But of course, the problem with your position, it seems to me, is maybe it's not insuperable, but the problem is that the contracting officer didn't say this exception is sufficiently minor that it's de minimis, it's not something that should influence our decision to qualify Monster. The contracting officer said there were no exceptions, and right under the category of Part 5, exceptions in about, I don't know, 24-point type is this exception. So it's hard to say that the contracting officer did all the analysis that you've just gone through and came to the conclusion that it was really okay.
Well, I want to respond to that because I'm looking at A1132. And it is true, and as you asked Mr. O'Connell on, it says Monster took no exceptions. Now, I don't mean to mince words, but I think the word took is important. It is not that Monster said, I know that I have to comply with X, Y, and Z, and I refuse to comply. They didn't say that. They said, here are the findings of our independent consultant. They laid it out. They were asked a question, are you compliant or not? They signed the certification, we are compliant. It was a yes or no answer, but they wanted to be fair to the government. They wanted to make sure that they laid it out for the government. They said, these are the minor exceptions. So I think it is fair to say we're talking about a passive exception. We've looked at your system as it stands today, Monster, and there are a few things that do not meet full compliance.
You're taking the position that the verb took means something other than that they voiced or articulated or set forth?
Or actively took it, exactly, as a statement of noncompliance. If, as the rules of a bid acceptability or proposal, bid responsiveness or proposal acceptability run, there is a difference between indicating that there may be an exception. There may be an exception which the contract allows us to fix as a matter of performance versus I refuse to comply. I will not comply.
All right. Did you have any other point you wanted to touch on as we were running?
Yes, I did. I did want to touch on the issue of Allied's failure to submit the signed certification. The RFQ was absolutely clear that the offeror had to submit a signed certification. Allied never submitted a signed compliant certification. They have never articulated the reasons why they did not submit that signed certification. They have said passingly in their briefs it was inadvertent. There has been no explanation why it was inadvertent. So under the settled law that they themselves cite in the Firth Construction and Oxbow cases, there is no signed statement by an Allied officer that they will comply with 508 versus Monster that says we will comply with 508.
Didn't they state they were in compliance?
They stated yes, but that was a yes or no. And a yes or no is not the same thing as a signed certification.
Punishable under 18 U.S.C. 1001, though, isn't it?
Well, I suppose if we went that far, but in the very Firth Construction case, which, with all due respect, I believe they miscited because it dealt with bid documents, it was whether a signature on a bid bond can be a substitute for the failure to sign a bid package with a signature of the offeror. Now, there are certain exceptions if you can prove that the officer of the company signing the bid bond was authorized as well to sign the bid. There is no signature by an Allied officer that they will comply with 508. And I think that clearly brings us under the rubric of Labatt.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Morehouse. We will hear a rebuttal from Mr. Claybrook.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to resist other comments. I just want to talk about the prejudice point that Mr. O'Connell made. Of course, this gets to the technical evaluation right. In particular. After finding several errors, several types of errors in the technical evaluation, the trial court then went on to say, but I find no prejudice. And I just want to tell you briefly why that was wrong. Technical was substantially more important than price in this best value analysis. And the CEO's finding that Allied had only a slight technical advantage was central to his source selection decision, as he found that the large price difference overcame Allied's technical advantage because that advantage was only what he called very slight. He even put it into 5.04%. Okay, so his whole decision collapses if his slight technical advantage finding was arbitrary and capricious. The Court of Federal Claims held that it was not arbitrary and capricious. Well, you just can't come to that conclusion when the CO's decision is based on significantly flawed, uneven-handed technical evaluations and arithmetic averaging without substantive analysis. In this situation, the determination that only slight technical superiority, that determination is by definition arbitrary and capricious and wrong as a matter of law. Now, that being the case, the matter has to be remanded to the agency to allow it to perform a proper best value analysis. The rationale of Alfa Laval and Impreza, which I cite in our briefs, is that when matters will be returned to the agency for another round of discussions, proposals, and then reevaluation from an award decision, no one knows how the offerors might change their proposals, so an incumbent like Allied is clearly prejudiced. The Weeks Marine case that the DOJ cited in their brief actually supports us because it has the same controlling rationale, and they're in a pre-award situation where they don't even get to show significant likelihood or, substantial, because it says it recognizes there aren't any offers or award decisions yet. And when you send it back down for new proposals and a new award decision, you're basically in a pre-award situation.
Let me ask you a question on that, and I don't know the answer to this, but I'm sure you do. does when you remand a case like this, suppose we were to remand because we found a problem with, let's say, this issue. Do you remand for a complete do-over, or do you remand, or can you remand for the agency to simply reassess the bids that were before it at the time and make a new evaluation of those bids as opposed to requiring a whole new proposal?
Well, either option is available depending on the circumstances. Right. Here, it's going to have to be a whole new...
Who gets to choose?
Why?
I'm sorry?
Who gets to choose which option? Well, do we get to choose?
No, but in this situation where we've been improperly disqualified, where there haven't been discussions, as soon as there are discussions, by law, it's required that it opens up the whole thing and they have to be new proposals and a new round of...
Haven't answered my question. I mean, Judge Bryson is asking, what happens? You say, well, sometimes there's a complete do-over and sometimes they just reassess the record that was in front of the CO.
I'm sorry. Let me try again. When discussions are required, then it requires by law.
Who decides when discussions are back?
Well,
back.
The court hopefully will decide that that's exactly
but
what's required
were to,
here.
But if we were to decide that you're not right on the discussions issue, but you're right on a couple of the other issues, one option would be to say we don't see this as necessitating a complete re-procurement.
That's conceivable, although it's a decision that would then go back to the contracting agency to decide whether or not they wanted to reopen or not.
I see. But that is something that ultimately would be typically left to the agency to make a determination between those two choices.
Right, unless both were disqualified and had to start over or...
Understood.
Right. The last point I'd make is that Allied makes an even stronger case on the showing on the record than Alfa Laval did in its case and Impreza did in its case. I'd like you to take a look one more time at the bar chart.
Those are the various ratings.
These are the various ratings by the evaluators. In the extremes, two of the evaluators had 30% better for Allied. One had 25% better for Monster. And what the CO did was just average them all out to come with this slight technical superiority. So Allied is the incumbent here. They're clearly prejudiced. And I appreciate your attention this morning.
Thank you. We thank all counsel. The case is submitted.